Welcome to the Weekly Juice Podcast, where we discuss all things real estate,
personal finance,
investing,
entrepreneurship,
and the many ways to achieve financial independence. We interview accomplished investors and entrepreneurs
with the goal
that their stories inspire you
to take control of your financial future.
Here to get your creative juices flowing while also documenting their own personal investing journeys are your hosts, Corey Jacobson and Ryan Bevilacqua.
Welcome back to another episode. As always, it's your boys here giving you another episode. So we have on special guest, Sean Winslow. Sean is a seasoned multifamily real estate investor that specializes in syndications and student housing rentals. He is the founder and managing partner of the real estate investing firm Greenbrier Capital, based out of Boston, Mass. He has a personal portfolio. He invests a little bit in New Hampshire. Then his syndication deals through Greenbrier Capital are down south a little bit near D1 universities. I'll let him chat about it, but he talked to North Carolina, Charleston, there's a couple other
Georgia
places.
Too, I think.
Georgia.
Yep.
And the coolest thing about their company is that they buy apartments in communities and that are emerging and in trending markets that suffer from deferred maintenance and management. So they go and fix these issues so they can create a clean and disciplined property to help support the communities.
Yes, sir. The biggest key here was student housing. So he loves going into areas that has like that big following for like a school, sports teams, all that. And then really like the parents, oftentimes, that's how it works. The parents are paying for kids to live. So they're willing to pay a little bit more for the kids' education. There's a lot of money to be made in student housing. But he goes through the entire episode talking about how a syndication works. Like that was the biggest breakdown. Like how do syndications work? How can you get in on the capital side? How can you get in on the operations side? And he breaks it down in very layman's terms so that people can understand. I thought that was like my favorite part of listening to him break this down and show us, kind of walk us step by step through these syndications.
Yeah, I thought we've only touched on these in previous episodes. So it's really cool. He kind of gave us the A to Z. Then he talks about building relationships with brokers and kind of how to leverage relationships, as we talk about again, masterminds to find deals and to scale your portfolio extremely quickly. The dude's only 32 and he's doing absolutely like incredible work.
Yep. And it's inspiring. Just people need to take away from this episode that there are actionable steps that you can take away. And somebody like Sean, like, yes, he's killing it. He's a master at what he does, but it's not unattainable. Like people can do this. You can go raise money from friends and family if you find the right deal. And he kind of explains that in the episode. So I think without further ado, let's bring him in.
Let's let him take it away. As you know, we talk a lot about financial independence, building revenue streams, and buying yourself more income. Wanted to give our listeners a special opportunity to potentially add a different revenue stream for themselves and into their portfolio. Tune into episode 110 to hear Corey and I peel back a couple layers on something that we're investing in currently at the moment. Just gives you a snapshot of where we are in our journey and gives you the opportunity to invest as well. This specific opportunity is to invest in a YouTube content monetization channel. And we go through every single step of the way, how we got involved and all the ins and outs of it. If you're interested after listening to the episode, feel free to drop us a DM. We're happy to answer any questions that you have and we'll point you in the right direction. Sean, officially welcome to the Weekly Juice Podcast. Corey and I are very excited to have you on here. I am super thrilled to interview a fellow New England guy and can't wait to hear your story, man. So thanks for coming on the show.
Ryan, Corey, thanks so much for having me, guys. I think you guys call your listeners juicers, right?
Yes, sir.
I think you could call me a juicer because I've been listening lately and you guys, I love the content. So I'm honored to be on here.
Appreciate that, man.
Thank you so much, man. Well, if you could give us a little brief background on yourself and kind of share the story of how you got into real estate investing.
Yeah. So I think like most people, it's not what I planned, you know. I grew up in New England in a small town to a family of entrepreneurs. And I started on that journey. I remember when I was younger, I wanted a new bike. And my dad told me, oh, well, I'll pay half of it, but the other half, you got to pay yourself. So you got to find a way to make money. So I started mowing my parents and neighbors' lawns and then turned that into something. And in the winter, I started, you know, shoveling snow because, you know, we live up here in the cold tundra. So I was an entrepreneur at heart. But then I think like most people, society conditions us that we got to do well in high school so we can go to a good college, do well there so we can get a good W-2 job. So that's what I did. I went to school, studied finance, and ended up working for a financial services company in Boston for a little over 7 years. And, you know, I love investing. I love finance. So I was in the right place. But at the end of the day, I missed, you know, I didn't really have the passion. And I was like, what am I doing here? You know, my values weren't aligned. I was selling a product that I really didn't believe in. I knew it wasn't the best way to grow wealth. Definitely wasn't the best, you know, tax advantage way to build wealth. And it was more like lining the pockets of people on, you know, the executives on Wall Street than it was the everyday person. So I knew how to make a change. And so what I ended up doing is that I was like, let's build a life that I want to live and then create a job around that, right? Like, don't focus on what I want to do for work, focus on what kind of life I want. So I started thinking about successful people I knew that had like the quality of life I wanted to, people that made a good income, but had a flexible schedule, right? And every single person I thought of that had that type of lifestyle was a real estate investor. So it's like, ding, 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 light bulb goes off. And then that also brought me back to a conversation I had with my grandfather, who was a successful businessman and loved investing in stocks. But one thing always hit me was that he said his retirement would be the real estate he owned. And so then that's when I knew I had to make a change. Went and studied took a real estate finance program at Boston University at night while I was still working in finance. And that kind of kicked everything off. And now I've syndicated and owned and operate over 400 units of multifamily and just over 500 student housing beds.
Wow. So I'm curious about the transition period. So you're making, I'm assuming, a pretty good living. Did you build up your portfolio? It sounds like you didn't. Like, did you build it up on the side and then at a certain point leave? Or did you just quit your job and you're like, I can't do this anymore? And then, like, while you were learning about the real estate, what was the transition like?
Good question. I kind of skipped over that. it was a little bit of both. So I started growing a small portfolio or a portfolio of smaller multis and got it up to about 25 doors. That was primarily in New Hampshire. So I was in Boston, but Boston's just a different animal. A property came across my email today that was selling for over $700,000 a door. And this is like a early 1900s build. So this is like a wow, different type of investing, and I needed cash flow, not a legacy play. So I started investing in New Hampshire. And once I got to 25 doors, I just realized I needed to make a change. You know, it was obviously providing cash flow. It wasn't equal to what I was making in finance, of course not. But I needed to make the change, and I was willing to make that sacrifice to really just focus all my energy on building this.
Very cool. Can you talk about real briefly? It's I like how that we got to this period very slowly, but like, I know you had 25 units. Can you talk about your first couple deals? Like, maybe just your first deal in general. Like, how did you go through the process, find the right deal and all that stuff? Just because a lot of people, I think, are intrigued and they're like, hey, listen, I have a bunch of stocks, or maybe I have a job and I have a 401k, Roth IRA, et cetera, but I want to be in real estate. I just don't know how to take the plunge and jump in.
Yeah. So I probably took the long way of doing it. Like I said, I took that real estate finance program at BU because I wanted to go more of like the bigger scale stuff. So I did a lot of education up front that probably wasn't really necessary. But then I ended up, my first deal as being a small, you know, triplex. So it's kind of funny how that happens. And what I did was Bigger Pockets found a real estate agent that was, you know, reputable, based on reviews on Bigger Pockets, reached out to them, did the same thing with a lender, and just built that team, right? And did the same thing with property management, built that team. And then I just started looking at deals. And then came across one in Manchester, New Hampshire, like I said, triplex, and took that down. I partnered with a friend and we both took it down with our own money.
Very cool. Can you talk about, I want to talk about like financial independence and just like the philosophy behind it a little bit. So what is your take on financial independence? Like, what's it mean to you and kind of why are you doing the things you're doing?
Yeah. So the cool thing about financial independence to me is that it can mean something different to everyone, right? You know, for someone, it could be like, you want a private jet. And for someone else, it could just be like, I just want enough to cover all my bills and not worry about money. And to me, that's what's really cool. It's why, you know, like, people love coming to America. It's the freedom to go pursue that. And that's what I love about it. So financial freedom to me is kind of in between there. Like, I don't necessarily need the private jet. You know, I'm going to work my butt off to maybe get there one day. That would be awesome. But financial independence to me is being able to provide to those that I care about, and not being, not worrying about, you know, the employer I'm working for, if they're going to let me go, or, you know, there's going to be layoffs or what have you. Just knowing I have enough passive income coming in to take care of not only myself, but my family, those I care about, and being able to give back. And that's why I named my company Greenbrier Capital Group, because it was the Greenbrier was the street I grew up on. So I want to be able to create this legacy that I can give back to my parents, my sister, and then eventually the family that I build.
Sure. Sean, I'm curious why you believe that real estate's like the best way to go about that solution, because we'll talk a lot about maybe on our Instagram. There's a lot of people we follow that, you know, investing in the stock market, investing in cryptocurrency, investing in e-commerce. And by the way, we do all of those, right? Real estate just happens to be what we're heaviest in. I'm curious why real estate for you. I know you mentioned that the people that you grew up looking up to had that type of lifestyle, but why do you feel like real estate's the best way to get you to your financial independence goals?
Yeah, it's a great question. And at, you know, when I was younger, I didn't really look at it this way, but I look at each property as its own business, right? And unlike stocks, you're allowed to acquire a lot more with a lot less, right? Because of leverage, the power of leverage. Not only can you use leverage from, you know, a financial position of getting debt on a property, but then you can leverage other people such as property management, you know, lenders, asset management, other partners, investors. And this allows you to really scale. And it's also just real estate, right? It's something tangible. There's only so much that we can create of it. And it's also a necessity, right? You know, people need food. They also need shelter. And that's what we're providing them. And that's why I believe, you know, it's one of the best investments. And from coming from a finance background, finance is all about risk management, right? Providing the best risk adjusted return. And over the long run, if you look at it, real estate does provide that. Dating back to the Great Depression, it has 300 less downturns than the stock market does, you know, and we all know that, you know, compounding is the eighth wonder of the world. Well, we want as little volatility as possible in terms of, you know, drawdowns to really compound, and real estate's going to provides that hands down.
Yeah. You know, I find it interesting. I'm just reading a lot of, not really reading articles. It's mostly Instagram and TikTok, but I'm just seeing what a lot of people are saying. And I'm not always buying into what a lot of people are saying, because everyone's like, well, you saw the crypto crash, you see the stock market crash, and then, like, the, you know, the real estate's next. And it doesn't really work like that. I mean, what happened in 2008, the banking systems took down real estate, which happened to drive down the rest of it. But just because you see a dip in a market, in a certain market, and also geographically, doesn't mean that the entire market's going to crash. And we can talk about what we think is going to happen with the market down in the episode. But I totally agree with you. And besides 2008, which was an anomaly, and it did happen and did impact a lot of people, not us, because we weren't investing then. But besides that, there's not a lot of times in the history of real estate that we know of, and we don't know everything, but that the real estate took like a huge dip. So we are totally with you for the long term. And we love real estate. We always talk about it. But I'm curious then on your current portfolio, and if maybe you could just dive into that. I know Rye asked some questions on the beginning of it, but like, talk to us about your portfolio in totality now, and maybe just like a timeline of how we got to that point.
Yeah. So it's just over 400 units of multifamily, and then an additional it's about 519 student housing beds. And think of that. It's just essentially the same thing. It's an apartment complex, but it's for student housing at a university. And how this all came to be is, as I mentioned earlier, that I really just wanted to scale, because I come from that, you know, institutional background, and I see the benefits of scale. Like, you just win in scale. Like, I own the smaller ones, and you have to replace a hot water heater. You have to replace a roof. There goes your cash flow for a year, right? But in a larger property, one, you're raising money for CapEx, so you're going to be able to cover that. And two, this the scale of the property can property can cover those, you know, the R&M, the repair and maintenance, and not kill your cash flow. So I knew I wanted to get into that, but I needed to know like how, because I think like most people, I felt I needed experience. I needed money to really be able to take these down. I didn't think they would take me seriously, like someone that was younger, you know, trying to take down 100+ unit facility. And it was actually funny how I learned about syndications is I was at that real estate finance program, and there was this other guy there that was taking it, and he worked for a syndicator in Boston, and he was taking the program to get out of syndication. And I took the program and learned syndication through him. And I was like, this is what I got to do. So that's how I found out a syndication. And then I realized, all right, well, I need to find someone that can like mentor me, coach me, because, you know, I don't know the first thing about it. At this point, I didn't, you know, I just knew what it was. You know, you pool money together from other people to take down, you know, real estate. And so through, you know, podcasts, networking online, I found someone that I connected with, not only someone that was doing what I wanted to do, but just had the same kind of, you know, morals that I wanted. And so I did wrote this person a handwritten letter and mailed it to him. And they called me, and they really appreciated that. And I think as we go on in the show, you'll probably hear me bring this up again, but like, to me, that's like, do that, write a letter, send it to someone. It really goes a long way because no one else is doing that. He called and he was really appreciative of that. He said, that's his trick. That's what he does. And that was I got my first mentor. And from there, I've just scaled, and I've joined other groups, masterminds. Guys, I can tell you, masterminds, surrounding yourself with people that are doing what you do, and even just like a notch above, or maybe 1 to 2 notches above, really just add rocket fuel to what you want to do. And I would not be where I am today without those.
I love it, man. We oftentimes go back and forth about talking about raising money for a bigger deal, because we're at the point now where we actually are just under contract for our first short-term rental, which is great. But we're talking about,
guys.
Yeah, thanks. Didn't close yet, but we're under contract. We can at least talk about it. So then after that, we're looking for higher cash flow, like a lot of people are. So short-term rental and then bigger deals, right? We're not interested in buying another long-term duplex, triplex, quad, just because we understand that the amount of work that it takes to get that is just as much as it would be potentially to get a 10, 20, 30 unit or more short-term rentals. But I have a specific question, because not only are we under contract for our short-term rental, we are looking to go into somebody else's syndication. And I always was under the impression that, you know, when you're an equity partner or a money partner, you're not active, you're passive, that you would be like somebody who's like 50, 60, 70, who's older, who's looking to get a return on money that's just sitting. But I'm curious, you're on the operational side of your syndications, right? But do you see a lot of people that are our age getting in on the passive sides too? And the reason why I asked the question is because we have a ton of things going on. We just think that we'd like to be as passive as possible. We found a really good deal. Do you recommend being operational or passive or both? I'm just curious if you have any thoughts on that there.
Yeah, so I would do both, guys. It's obviously a great place to put money. I put money there, but I would also be on the operational side, because why not? Or be both in the same deal, and you make money on both sides, but you're also, right, you're also learning a lot along the way. And guys, it's work, of course, but it's fun and it's rewarding. And to answer your question about, you know, the age thing, yeah, it's most of it definitely is older, you know, older people, right? Because they generally have more disposable income, more money to invest. But I'm starting to see younger and younger people do it. I have a lot of friends that are either like, I want in on your next deal, or as soon as I have money, I'm investing. And I know other people that raise money, and they've started to attract, you know, a younger crowd of investors. And I think it's all about just relating to people, right? Like, I know this is cliche and people say it a lot, but people like to do business with those that you know, like, and trust. And you guys are creating that with this podcast. So I would imagine, you know, listeners would love to invest with you. One, because they trust you, obviously, and they like you, and they want to, you know, reap the rewards with you and go on that journey with you. So, yeah, I would highly recommend it.
Cool. So, We were going to do this later in the show, but since I asked the question, let's talk about syndications and we'll come back to your personal portfolio.
Yeah.
Maybe if you could just, the word syndication kind of, maybe it scares people. Can you give us the elevator pitch on like how maybe your syndications work, break down some numbers and just what they are specifically?
Yeah. Like syndication A to Z. I think it's hard for people to conceptualize what it actually is. I think people think it's like crowdfunding, right? Just sourcing money and putting it into a passive deal, but there's so many other things that go into it. So if you could break it down for us, that'd be awesome.
Yeah. Syndication, just like any other term in finance, it sounds fancy to make people look smart, and it's really not that, it's really not that hard. But what it is it's essentially investors pooling their money together to go buy something. And the way I like to explain it, like in the most, layman's terms possible, is if you remember when you were younger, maybe you wanted to buy a gift for your parents or maybe your teacher, but you couldn't afford it alone. So you pool, money with your siblings or your classmates to go buy that gift and give it to them. And that's essentially what a syndication is. And then to get more technical with it, what we specifically do is we buy, 150 to 250 unit multifamily apartment complexes that are, 1980s or newer, B class, in a primary or secondary market. And as we get into it, it really all depends where your equity sources are coming from, because sometimes you have to be even more specific than that. They're looking for like certain things if it's like a private equity or institutional family office investor. But if it's, mom and pops, you can kind of get more, like by that I mean just like a retail investor, you can get kind of more broad. So that's what we look for. And so what we do is we find these deals primarily through broker relationships, and we get it under contract, and we use something called, so in order to raise money, the SEC makes you either file a security, which is extremely expensive and a very long process. So think like, IPO, like they are filing for a security. So in order to get around that, you need to file for an exemption and get approved for that exemption. And the common exemption for syndication is Regulation D, and more specifically, 506B and 506C offerings. And the main difference between the two is that 506C, you can market. So you guys could come on this podcast and be like, I have this deal. These are the projected returns, minimum investment, blah, blah, blah. But you only can offer it to accredited investors. And what an accredited investor is, at least right now, there's mumblings that they're going to change this. But what it is you've, as a individual, you've earned $200,000 or more in the previous 2 years, with expectations that you're going to do that again this year, or you have a liquid net worth of $1 million or more minus your primary residence. And then if you're filing jointly, that income goes up to $300,000 per year. So that's what makes you an accredited investor. And there's rumors that, the net worth is going to go up to $10 million, and I think maybe $400,000 for the income. I can't remember. Don't quote me, but I've heard rumblings about that. But I digress on that point. The 506B, then you can actually, offer it to non-accredited investors. So people that don't meet those two thresholds. However, you cannot market the offering. So, I couldn't come on here. You guys couldn't come on your podcast and say you had a deal. You'd only be able to show that to your, what they call pre-existing substantial relationships. And the SEC in general doesn't like to give any clear guidelines to anything they say, because they want to have an out to anything, right? However, there was this one group, big syndicator, that wrote a letter to the SEC and said, these are the steps we take to qualify someone. Would this be enough? And they actually said yes. And what it is they took a three-step approach. So three touch points, right? It could be an email, it could be in person, a phone call, a Zoom, and a text, what have you. And that those count as three touch points. And as long as in those three touch points, you have, verified their financial situation and that this type of investment would be appropriate to them, then you've established that relationship. And then from there on, you can start showing them deals. I hope I didn't go too much into the weeds, guys. But
no, that was perfect. Just explaining the 506B and C. But That's so interesting. So is it kind of like a formality? Like do people that you already know, like, and trust, you just have to have those touch points in case you get audited at some point? I just wonder if that's like,
yeah, exactly.
Is that kind of how it works?
Exactly. I know someone who's been audited by the SEC twice, and it wasn't for any of their doing. It was a partner they brought on. They actually went to like a RIA meeting and blasted the deal. And you can't do that because you clearly don't know every single person in that room, or at least most likely you don't. And wow. So this person told me it's like a intense audit, worse than getting audited by the IRS.
I could imagine. I mean, we just heard there's heavy regulations on these things. So we're walking on eggshells a little bit, just trying to get our feet wet and kind of figure out the ins and outs of everything before we move forward. But as Corey mentioned, we are kind of in the process of exploring a specific deal.
That would be the B506. We're not accredited investors. Right. So that would be like, for lack of a better word, I guess, friends and family.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, you guys could still be part of a 506C, even though you're not accredited. Because as a general partner, now guys, I want to preface it. I'm not a syndication attorney. So obviously check with everything I'm saying. But from my understanding, from my syndication attorney, is that that doesn't matter. You're a general partner, so you can still, you know, offer this offering.
I see. If you're on the operational side.
You wouldn't be able to. And actually, you might be still able to invest in it because
if it's your deal,
you're taking material part. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So let's just say you have a deal, and someone has a deal under contract. They present it to you, and you get the contracts from them. What's your recommendation to go from there? Do you send it to any real estate attorney, a syndicating attorney? Like what's your recommendation?
Yeah. So I have two different attorneys I use. I have one attorney that he handles all the contracts. So in negotiating PSA, any type of contract we have with the deal. And then I have a separate syndication attorney that's all they do. They draft up the PPM, which stands for private placement memorandum. And that's essentially a document that really just tells the investor everything that could possibly go wrong in the deal. You know, it's a CYA, essentially, you know, that they're supposed to read through and realize everything that could go wrong. And then they sign, that's the doc. And they also create the operating agreement of how everything's going to operate. Cool. And that's what we use that attorney for.
Perfect. All right. Thanks for that. So, what I think would probably be beneficial to everybody listening to is to like do a mock deal or just talk about one, and you can generalize numbers a little bit, but I just want to kind of know how you would structure a potential deal that someone would invest in, right? Like, just thinking like you could pick whether it's a like 100 to 400 unit, whatever it is, but just, I'm thinking of like, can someone come in as an equity partner with 5% equity partner for $100,000 down? Or like, do you allow cash flow partners where people just give you a lump sum and you pay them 10 to 12% on their cash? Just thinking like for our visual people here, can you put together a deal for us, or maybe one that you've done, and just talk us through the ins and outs?
Yeah, I'll talk about, since I can't really talk about, you know, future returns, I can talk about deals we've done and how we set those up. And I can just talk in generalities how you can. The cool thing about, you know, syndications and structuring deals is there's so many ways to do it, right? And it all really depends on who you're raising money from. So if you're raising money from a retail investor like, you know, us or people we know, you know, you kind of have a lot of flexibility in how you can structure a deal. But if you're raising from private equity, family offices, you're not going to have as much flexibility because they're going to be writing a big check and they're going to call the shots, right? So those are kind of the pros and cons between the two. But I'll talk about a recent deal we did. It was 197 units, multifamily. And how we structured it is investors came in and we owned it 50-50, right? So meaning, we shared 50-50 on the depreciation. However, from the return side, it wasn't 50-50. What it was they got a 7% preferred return. And what that means is they get paid 7% per year before anyone else does. And one thing you gotta check on when you see these, like we call them prefs, right? When you see pref returns, is you gotta see, do they mean I'm actually gonna get this 7%? Every single year, or is it just going to accumulate over time until we can reach where it averages out over 7%? Because those are two different things. And sometimes investors think they're going into a deal where they're going to make 7% every single year, but they actually make 1 or 2% in the first year, 3% in the second, and then you know, catch up over the remaining years. But on this one, we're actually, it's frothy enough and it's has big enough cash flow that we're paying 7% pref every single year. And on the back end, we have a waterfall structure. And what that simply means is they get 100% when we go to sell the property or refinance, they get 100% to 12%. And then they get 70% to 14%. And then 16% and above, it goes to 50-50. When I say them, I'm talking about limited partners, people who are investing, and then us general partners, that's we get the other side. So that type of deal is a very good deal for a limited partner. And because they're, you know, they're getting that pref first before we get paid a dime. And then the waterfall is they're getting the majority of it to a certain point where it gets 50-50.
So let's talk about numbers. For example, like say Corey and I, or just one of us jumped into this deal. What's the down payment that we would owe you? And then can you talk us through like that percent, 7% on that number? And like what, just like exactly what our returns would be, just so people can get an idea.
Yeah. So if you had if you just use a round number, $100,000, 7 pref, you'd make $7K a year, right? Through the hold period. And then you'd also get, you know, depreciation. So for that deal, I think the average investor got $49,000 in depreciation per 100K, meaning they could offset any passive income that they have up to that, you know, 49K. Again, I'm not a tax advisor, so check with your tax advisor. But if you're a real estate professional, which is really cool, like, you know, we are, or like a real estate agent, a lender, you can actually offset that against active income as well, which is extremely powerful. And so you'd get that for the 100K, you get the $7,000 pref. And then on the back end, depending on how much the profit was, you know, it would pretty much average out to anywhere between, depending on how fat of a deal it was, I believe that they're going to get around like 17 to 18% average annual return.
Very cool. I like that. And then can you just talk about like when you decide to sell off a property, like how that impacts other investors? So for example, like when we're looking at a syndication deal, we're like, well, we want to hold for the long term, right? And then, you know, you hope it goes up a shitload for appreciation, but also
right.
Like some of the deals have monthly cash flow that they pay you. It's not annual. It's just like monthly you're getting a return. So
yep. You
don't really want that ever to end, right? If it keeps going up. So can you talk about kind of how that's structured? And I guess it's the managing partners that have all control of that, and the limited partners are just kind of at like at will to whenever you guys want to sell.
Exactly. But we preface it before we get into this relationship that generally we want to hold, you know, 5 to 7 years. Could it come earlier? Yes. Could it come later? Yes. But generally it's that 5 to 7 area timeframe. And the investor has to be comfortable with that. We never want to take their last $100,000. We never want to take $100,000 that they may need in a year or two. We want them to be comfortable. Like, you're not gonna be able to touch this in 5 to 7 years, potentially. Obviously things happen in life, and we will work with investors if they do desperately need it, but they need to know that could impact the deal. So yeah, when it comes to that time to sell, we do make the decision, and then we either, you know, sell or refinance. And the cool thing about like structuring deals, you can really do anything. You know, there's some syndicators that will, you know, set up this type of return I was just talking about, but then they'll go refinance. And if it's a fat enough deal, they'll be able to cash out all the equity. And then what they'll do is just keep it forever. But then the split will switch. It'll become more favorable to the general partner, right? Because now that limited partner has no skin in the game and they're not doing anything, and the general partners are still putting, you know, sweat equity into it. And those are really cool deals because you've made your money for the first 5 years. Now, essentially, you're making unlimited money going forward for, you know, no risk to you.
Sure. So there's a lot of platforms out there online that I think people are seeing now too, right? Just like being on social media. One that jumps out to me is Fundrise. Can you talk about the difference between your company and what you guys do on the syndication front versus an online platform like Fundrise, and kind of like, I guess, the pros and cons of each? Just we have a lot of people that ask for our recommendations, like, hey, which way do you think I should go? And we're just curious on like what you would recommend for someone that has, you know, they have passive income, they're ready. Let's just say they have $50,000 to $100,000 they're ready to drop. I assume it probably would need to be a little bit over 100. I think some of these deals are rarely do you find one for 50 grand in my estimation. I could be totally wrong with that, but just looking for your expertise being in the game for a while.
Yeah, there's definitely some you still can find for 50 grand. Some I think you can even find for 25 grand, but usually the bare minimum is 50, and more and more we're seeing 100 as the minimum. But Fundrise, well, I'll give them credit. They've done a phenomenal job marketing. Like, everyone knows what Fundrise is, right? And it's a form of syndication. They do, you know, offer a different type of offering, and their minimum is usually, I don't know, what, 5,000, sometimes even $500, I think. Yep. It really depends on the deal. It's a great way to invest, but my only thing is that you don't have as much say in the investment as you do with a pure private placement syndication, because we're showing you the deal and you can say yes or no. And also we're more selective because we don't have like billions of dollars that we have to put to work. You know, I wish I had that problem, but, I don't, right? So I can be more selective in the offering. And I feel like some of these bigger, you know, like the Fundrises of the world, sure, they have so much money coming in that they need to put to work that they have to go buy something. And I'm not saying they're, you know, making an investment that is bad, but they're not probably as, you know, stringent on it, right? They're not really sticking to it as like we are, because we don't have to put this money away. Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. No, and that brings me to another question, and I think it's a perfect segue. Can you talk about the markets that you guys at Greenbrier specifically invest in, and like why you chose those markets? And then I also want to talk about your strategy for student housing, because I think it's brilliant in going to D1 universities. And I heard that on another show that you talked about, and I think our listeners would enjoy that very much.
Yeah, of course. So I picked the Southeast, primarily the Carolinas and Georgia. And there's a multitude of reasons I did that. One is I was in Boston at the time. As I alluded to earlier, it's just like a different type of investment. You know, it's like a legacy play. Like, yeah, you can get some cash flow, but I've had brokers tell me like, oh, this is a great legacy buy. You know, you're probably going to lose money for the first 3 to 4 years, but in the long run, it's a great investment, which they're 100% right. Right. Like, nothing's going to happen to Boston, but that's not the type of investment I'm looking for or my investors. So I knew I had to go somewhere else. So then I started looking to other areas that were still like strong markets. I didn't want to just go somewhere just because of that cash flow, right? I also wanted to be a solid market that I knew would last. And so I love Charlotte, Raleigh-Durham, you know, the Research Triangle, Atlanta, Charleston, those markets, because they all have the same thing in common. Net migration, jobs are going there, you know, income's growing there. We have criteria. We actually have a spreadsheet that, you know, we'll put in all the data and then it'll turn green if it hits it. And now it doesn't have to hit everything, right? But like, we just want to make sure that we're in a solid market that can last any type of downturn. And one, yes, we do buy in cash flow. And and the reason we buy cash flow is not, you know, what everyone usually pumps is that, you know, financial freedom, we're going to sunsets and palm trees, that type of stuff. Yeah, I can provide that. But the main reason to invest in cash flow is to weather storms, because, you know, we're about to come into one right now, it seems like. And if you're not cash flowing, you could be forced to sell it. And that's what happened to a lot of people in 08. And if you buy on cash flow, in good times, it can pay for that sweet vacation. But, you know, in bad times, it can save you from having to sell. And then I could jump into student housing if you want.
Yeah, that'd be great.
So yeah, first deals were multifamily. And then I got into student housing because one of my mentors was doing it, and it just made perfect sense, because I looked back to when I was in school, and it was in 2008, and we all know what happened then. And the only reason I knew anything was going on in the world is because I was studying finance. I think if I was not studying finance, I would not have even realized, you know, what was happening in the world, just because you're so oblivious to what's going on outside of your university, right? And I also looked back and realized, I don't remember anyone having to leave because they could no longer afford to go. And I hope that doesn't come off wrong, but the way I look at it is that, you know, families have either already allocated that money to send their kids to school and they're not going to pull them out. Two, there's grants, there's scholarships. People have, you know, this, they have done a lot of work to go to school, and they have the funds allocated. And two, you see a lot of people when times are tough and there's layoffs that people go back to school because they want to, you know, separate themselves in a tight job market. So they'll come back, get a master's or just get a different degree. So for me, I think student housing going forward is a great spot to be. And plus, there's not as much competition. It kind of fell out of favor, especially at the beginning of COVID, because we all know what happened there. And so there's a lot less competition. And I just think it's great place to move forward. And they actually cash flow like crazy because you're obviously, you know, charging per bed.
Here's the way that I look at student housing, and I don't know nearly as much about it as you do, but I just, like, from an outside perspective, who I'm not invested in it, just call it as it is. Most of the time, the people that are paying for the student housing are the parents of the people that are going to school. Most of the time, not all the time, right? So they have generally more income to spend, generally better credit scores, generally more stability.
And they co-sign. That's one reason we love it too.
And they co-sign, exactly. So, and the parents, knowing the parents, they want their kids to get a great education. So they're going to give them the best environment to try to do that, right? It's not like somebody's 23, 24 years old who is just getting out of school, who's financially supporting themselves maybe, right? They have the backing of their parents. So for example, I know a lot of parents that paying $650 versus $850, if it's for their kid, it doesn't matter. They're paying $1,050, right? The fact is that with the parents backing it, I think student housing is just such a great tool and a great asset class. So I don't know more about it than you do, but I just thought I would throw that in there. I thought from an outsider. Yeah.
Yeah. I 100% agree with you. That's one of the main reasons we love it. And to your point of like the luxury buildings. Yeah. It's a easier way to get into a class A property than like class A multifamily. Because again, it just cash flows better. There's less competition, but you're buying a solid asset that's not going to need as much, you know, generally, you know, repair and maintenance. And it's, at first, I was really skeptical of student housing because I thought back to my days of going to like frat parties and people putting holes through the ceilings and walls. Yep. Like I've literally seen a kid like run through a wall like the Kool-Aid man. So I was really skeptical at first, but this is it. When you're investing in these complexes, it's a completely different thing. You know, you've got people that live on site, like staff that live on site that are there 24/7, which is a completely different thing. And we love it. Brian, to your point of the D1. Yeah, we love D1 just because it's a solid institution that generally is not going to go anywhere, right? And we always want to make sure that the trend of enrollment is going up. It's not decreasing. We want it to be, you know, a variety of offerings of degrees, not just, you know, one degree. And those are kind of the things we look for, you know, because it's really, when you're underwriting a student housing deal, yeah, it's the financials, but it's also the institution itself. You really need to underwrite the institution.
Definitely. I want to talk about, so this could kind of probably encompass all the deals you're talking about, but specifically, like, how are you guys currently finding deals? And, you know, it's one thing to talk about these huge syndications, but I think people are like, well, how the hell would I even find one? And then when you find one, how the hell do you close on it and make the right offer and negotiate? Because a lot of times we're finding ourselves, like, we had to make 5-6 offers before we just landed on our first short-term rental. A lot of people will be like, I had to make 20, dude, like, or 30. Like, how did you get it on 5? And actually, secretly, it was only on 2, not 5, which is sick. But there, the stories we keep hearing are people like, 15, 20, I don't have the time for this. So let's talk about how you find them, but then also how the hell do you get these things under contract?
Man, it's a numbers game to your point. Like I was looking at the other day, we're getting close to like 1,000 deals. It might even be over it that we've analyzed over the last few years. And it really is a numbers game. When we started off, we would, you know, analyze deals and it's like, no, it's not that it's good, but it's only good at this number. I'm not going to worry about sending an LOI, but now we just rip LOIs. Like we won't do it to like annoy brokers. Like obviously I'll talk to them first and be like, hey, if I submit at this number, is it even worth it? And they'll say yes or no. And if they say yes, I will. Cause it's a numbers game. The more, you know, LOIs and offers you send out, the better, you know, chance you have of getting it. And so how we do it is all through broker relations. I know a lot of people don't like that. They like to go more off market, but when you look at these big deals, 90%+ of them are going to be listed by a broker. Yes, you still can find them off market. It's just a lot harder to do. Like if you're doing the, you know, duplex to 50, 60 unit, of course, off market, but these bigger complexes, you majority of them are with brokers. And so, and when I say brokers, talk about commercial broker that works for like a Marcus & Millichap, Cushman & Wakefield, JLL Colliers, and so on and so forth. And how I've done it is it's all about building relationships, just like in anything. You know, like I've said earlier, people want to do business with people they know, like, and trust, and the same thing with them. They want to be able to hang out with you, have a beer, grab a coffee, whatever, you know, go on a ski trip, go play golf. And so what I did is, in order to get on these brokers' lists and stand out, like, you could either go to like the Crexies of the world, the LoopNets, and see who's selling deals and get on those lists, or go to the brokerages websites and look in their that target market and get on their list. But what really worked for me is getting a list. And I got this from my lender. So you're gonna have to go someone that can get the data of sales of multifamily. And they got me in my target markets. They got me at the actual brokers that are doing deals, because you don't want to waste your time. You don't want to send it to a broker that's not really selling anything, right? So I got a list of brokers that were actually transacting, and it would give me the total dollar volume and then the unit count. And so then you could figure out, by dividing the units into the total dollar amount, what dollar per unit they were selling. So is it an A class? Okay, I'm getting rid of that because I want B and C. And then I would just send emails. I would send an intro email, which I can, if your listeners want, I can, I have a whole, you know, PDF of what I do to build these relationships. And part of that is an email template. So I have an email template, and then I attach what I call my credibility kit. And if you're starting out, get a mentor, get a coach, and leverage their credibility to put in front of these brokers. And you send the email, and then you immediately, you know, maybe a couple minutes later, pick up the phone and dial. And you just keep trying until you get them. And if you don't get them, what my trick was is I would send a handwritten letter with a Starbucks gift card. And I would say, hey, here's a coffee on me. Next time I'm in town, let's get another one in person. And I'd leave my, you know, number or business card or what have you. And they would obviously call, because I'm, you know, standing out. They get calls and emails from everyone all day, but they don't get a letter with a gift card much. So they would call me. But if you do get them on the phone on that first one, the plan for me is obviously tell them what you're looking for, but spend majority of the time just talking to them, like who they are, what they like, you know, and just build that personal relationship, and then go, hey, I'm going to be in your market. If it's a market you don't live in, I'm going to be in your market, you know, in 2 weeks. Can we grab coffee or lunch? Treat, it's on me. And they say, yes, you get on a plane. If it's not in your backyard, and you go there and you meet with them. And again, it's about building a personal relationship. And I just get them to talk. They have kids. I get them to talk about the kids. They like to golf. They like basketball. I get to talk all about that. And at the end of the day, they're going to love you, because you made them talk about their passion, and you probably said like five words, but they're going to love you. And it works. And at the end of it, then you say, this is what I'm looking for. And one question I love to ask too is like, hey, think about the buyers you work with, the one that you love the most. What does that person do? And they'll tell you. And then you're like, all right, I'm going to be that buyer. And then stick to your word and be that buyer. And that's what I've done to really grow relationships. And then they're going to start sending you deals, right? And what a lot of people do is they only respond to the deals they like, but you got to respond to the deals you don't like and tell them why. And that goes a long way to them. It actually goes further to them than replying to one that you like. So do that, continue to do that, submit offers. And then it's all about keeping in touch, you know, like personalizing stuff. Like when I closed on that deal we were talking about earlier about the 197 unit last Christmas, the broker had a son. And he's a Braves fan, and we all know the Braves just won the World Series. So I sent him a Braves World Series onesie. And dude, that he still talks to me about it this day. Like it goes such a long way. And that's what it's about. And I'm not just doing it to try to get ahead. Like I generally am building a relationship with this guy. I enjoy this guy. We've played golf. And that's what it's about. And that's how I've been able to get, one, a lot of deals in front of me, because it's a numbers game. And two, deals accepted.
Yeah, I think what's important about what you just said that probably gets overlooked is people are listening like, well, what do you mean? Why do you have to go through all this? Like, don't brokers, like, they want more buyers. They want you to send people deals. And I think it really comes down to the fact that, like, if they don't think that you're trustworthy or you're going to close, why would they spend it, waste any time?
That's the biggest thing.
Like, why would they waste their time looking? Even who cares what your criteria is if you're just looking, right? And so I guess I don't want to toot our horn, but what happened recently is we met a broker, an agent who was like, you know, I'm looking at the short-term rental space. And the first deal he sent us, we made an offer. And the second deal he sent us, we made an offer and we got accepted. And he's like, oh, these guys are serious. Like, they actually want to do this. Like, they're not just saying it. And we got lucky, you know, to get that second one accepted. But it all started with like proving to the agent that like, no, we're not just saying this because we want to get into the game. It's like, we're already playing the game. Let's close. And we are the trustworthy guys that, you know, you hope that we are. So I love that you mentioned that. Rod, did you have something else that you wanted to go into before the last segments?
Yep. I actually wanted to talk about raising private capital because this is hard for a lot of people, or they think it's hard, right? So first of all, thank you for the A to Z on syndication and going through it and giving us the ins and outs. But this is, I think, a daunting topic of conversation is people are like, okay, I don't have the money, but I have a deal or I know how to find the deal. Let's just say, for example, they know how to do that. But even if not, how does one raise private capital? Like, where, I guess, can you talk just through the process of finding partners to come in and jump in on deals with you? Like, how do you do it? What do you market to? And maybe that'll help us kind of conceptualize a little bit.
Yeah. Talking money to people is definitely uncomfortable at the beginning, right? I think we all can admit that. But the best way, I think, to start, if you've never done it before, is talk to friends and family. Even if they don't have money, everything you do is about repetition and practice. So I think that's the best way to start, because if you fall flat on your face, who cares? It's your buddy's just going to give you a hard time, or but then it's about building credibility. And to do that, people need to see you taking, you know, action consistently. Like you mentioned, you submitted those two LOIs, you know, then the broker took you seriously. Like, you had credibility. And it's the same thing with raising money. So go to meetups, you know, join mentor programs, go to conferences, start a podcast, start an Instagram account. Even if you haven't done anything, just show your journey and it builds credibility. And I know this is probably the third time I've said this, but it's all about knowing the person, liking the person, and trusting the person. Well, they can't do that if you're not like showing yourself out there taking action. And you could even stumble across someone who, you know, has a lot of money and they just like you because they like your work ethic, right? They see how hard you're working and they see the potential and they want to hitch their wagon to you. But you're not going to do that by just sitting at, you know, home and hoping you can just, you know, run into someone or call a friend and family. So it's all about putting yourself out there. That's what's worked for me. And then it's creating something where you can then, you know, attract people to, whether it be a podcast, an Instagram, and then you got to send them somewhere, right? Because yes, you can have this podcast and talk all day, but if you don't have any way to capture their information, then kind of like, what's the point, right? So the big thing, you might've heard this term, lead magnet, right? Something where they want to go get it, right? And then they will put their name and email and possibly phone number in to get that. And then they get the resource sent to them and then they're on your list. And then again, it's about building that trust and that credibility, because they're going to see maybe your monthly newsletter, what your company's doing, what you're doing. And again, they're going to build more trust, right? And so it's all about being in front of people. And I know like we're probably all sick of getting blasted with emails, but it's about, you know, staying top of mind. Everyone says it's who you know, but to me, it's no, who knows you? You know, when someone thinks like, I want to invest in real estate, they got to think Ryan and Corey, they got to think Sean. And to do that, you got to stay top of mind. So that's what's really worked for me, raising money. I don't know if that really answers.
Yeah, that was, question. No, that was great. That was great start to the conversation. I want to dive a little bit deeper here.
Yeah.
Can you talk about like the three major investing pools or investor pools that people raise capital from? Like maybe either outside of friends and family, like where can people navigate through?
Yeah. So yeah, like you said, the first one is friends and family and just your network that you build. And that is probably it all depends what you want in life, just like in anything. But that's probably the ideal group to raise from, just because you have more flexibility and more control with them. And it's just cool to offer this type of investment to someone that usually doesn't get presented it, right? And that's one thing I love about syndications is you know, I used to think this was something for the ultra wealthy, but no, it's everyday people can invest in it. And that's what I love. So that's one group. And then you've got kind of your, what I call strategic partners. And that would be like Ryan and Corey, right? Ryan and Corey partner with me. They have their own network and they raise from them and I raise from my network and we combined it and then go take down a deal. So that's the second one. And the cool thing about that is, you know, you get to partner with really cool people and build relationships and also make money along the way. What's not to like about that? And you get to scale faster. And that's what, you know, this business is about, right? Scaling. And then the third one is more institutional. So I've mentioned this before, private equity, family office. These are the big check writers. Generally, they're going to write 80 to 90% of the raise. So say it's a $10 million raise. They're going to write anywhere from $8 to $10 million of it. And then you're going to have to bring the remainder, $1 to $2 million. But generally how that's structured is they're then going to get 80 to 90% of the deal. So it's not as, you know, financially rewarding for us, but it's a way to scale and scale a lot faster. And generally, another con is not as much flexibility. They're going to have a lot more say. You know, these institutional investors are generally all IRR driven, so internal rate of return. And how you really beef up, and I don't want to get too technical, but how you really beef up the IRR is by turning money over fast, right? Time value of money. So they're going to want to sell as fast as possible. And you as an operator, that might not be what you want to do. So that's another con to that.
I really like that. So my last question before we wind down the show is, what type of paperwork or pamphlet, flyer do you put together and what does it include? Because, so for example, like it had an amazing flyer, right? It had a bunch of pictures that told us like the forecast of what the property was going
to. It's like a PowerPoint pitch deck kind of.
Yeah, that was turned into PDF. Yeah. And it basically just walked us through, like I said, the layout of the property, our rate of return, what cash flow we'd get monthly, if they sell or refinance, what would happen to us. And it was just like very thorough. Even though we're a little bit wet behind the ears, we have to kind of figure out the contract part. But I loved that. And I was like, listen, this is bite size. It was like only like 5-6 pages, but I could see it. I could taste it. And then I was like, I was comfortable with it. So curious if you have any, I guess, cornerstones that you put in yours or what you send out.
Yeah. So we send two different documents. One is just like a 1-2 pager, just like a quick flyer, just to kind of, you know, get the buzz going on the deal before we have everything put together, just to let our investors know that we have something coming. And that will just, you know, have a couple pictures of the property, information of like unit size, location, you know, B-class, vintage. And then generally we'll do like the projected structure and returns. And then on the bigger pitch deck, what we like the marketing packet, which we'll have like on a webinar and send to each individual investor, that is like what you're referring to, where it's multiple pages, really nice, dense with information. And yeah, that'll be the same thing. We'll, you know, photos, business plan, return profile. We even put the pro forma in there. Recently, we put something in our sensitivity analysis on our cash flow model. We have a sensitivity analyzer, which we look at few key stats like IRR, vacancy, what else, cap rate. There's some other that I'm not thinking of right now, but we do a sensitivity analysis. So we'll be like, well, what if the cap rate goes up by X or down by X? How's that going to affect the deal? Because we really want to know, like, especially in today's market where everything is just so, you know, it's tighter than normal. And there's a lot of uncertainty in the market. We just want to know like what can happen. So we'll put that in the marketing pack too. So the investor can see like, well, what if, you know, you're underwriting 6% vacancy. What if it goes to 10? What does the deal look like? So we'll put that in there as well.
I like that.
Great. So right before we get to the core four, which is the second last segment of our show, I just want to ask you, what are your future goals with your business? You know, you mentioned that you don't need to get to a jet, but you definitely want to be at a level of financial freedom that you can, maybe you do want to get to a jet, right? Like what are your future goals with your business and then with your just personal?
Yeah. So maybe it will be a jet. I don't know. I want to get to at least $500 million in assets under management in the next 8 years. Or actually when I'm 38, so 6 years now. I know it's possible. It's going to take a lot of hard work, and it's not just to, you know, create wealth for myself. but it's also to create wealth for my family. And then I always think of this Steve Wozniak, you know, one of the founders of Apple. He has this story. I don't know if you guys have heard it, but he was asked in an interview, you know, when did you know you made it or when you were successful? And I'm paraphrasing, but he said, when I was driving home one day through my neighborhood, passing multi-million dollar house after multi-million dollar house, and they were all owned by Apple employees, I knew I made it. And I'm even getting goosebumps right now, guys. Like when I first heard that, I just got goosebumps. And I was like, I want that. Like, I want to be able to create legacy wealth for other families, you know, directly through my business and through the offerings we provide. So that's kind of my goal. And then, you know, give back to those that need it. You know, they're, you know, specifically children, you know, they weren't asked to be brought in this world. And, you know, unfortunately, there's a lot of stuff going on in the world that we could help with. So that's another driving force.
Cool. Well, I think you answered one of our core four questions, but we'll go back to it. So the first question of the core four would be, what is your favorite business or investing or real estate book?
Ooh, that's a good question, guys. I got a whole bunch back on the shelves back there. But usually for business, I would say E-Myth, but I'm currently reading Who Not How, and that's really speaking to me right now. So I'm going to go with that. You know, it's. I think we were talking about this earlier before we started like recording about, you know, assistance and, you know, getting people to manage social media because it's like a full-time job. It's just so true. Like, I know I need to hire a VA for some things, you know, and as soon as I brought on a partner in my business, we just exploded, right? I started off doing everything, you know, building relationships with the brokers, underwriting the deals, raising the money. And now I have a partner that does the majority of the underwriting. And he loves it. You know, I'll send him a deal and he'll crank it out so fast. And it's just allowed us to get, you know, grow so much faster. And I know I have a lot more to go on Who Not How. And for those that aren't familiar with it, it's essentially like whenever you have a problem presented to you, it's not how can I do it, it's who can do it. And yeah.
We love that book. We talk about it on a number of episodes. And the reason is because you wouldn't believe that there are people that don't like that like the things that you don't like. And that's something that we just recently discovered. It's like, well, I hate doing XYZ. Doesn't everyone hate doing XYZ? No, there's a lot of people that love doing that. So you got to find that person. That's the whole who, not how thing.
Yeah, I really like that. I think Axel can probably hold us both accountable for hiring VAs. I think we've said it out loud to him twice. And it's just like, he gave us the how-to in his episode. So
that's episode 105 with,
Yeah, so go back if you're listening and you want to know how to hire a VA. Axel's done it. So go to episode 105. He'll tell you how it's done. But
I say the same thing to him. And we were actually talking once before we both, he didn't have it either. And he clearly did get it and I didn't. So
it's all good, dude. We'll hold each other accountable on that one. It'd be amazing to take a lift off here. But second question of the core four, this one's going to probably be a little bit different for you just because you're a little bit further down and you're further along in your real estate investing journey. But just want your thoughts. If you had an additional $50,000 of discretionary income, we just gave you a check today, tax-free, how would you invest it, spend it? Just what would you do with it? How would it impact your life?
Great question, guys. So I'd probably take 10% of it because one of the missions of Greenbrier is to give away at least 10% per year of our profit to, you know, a nonprofit or a charity of our liking. So I would take 10% of that, so $5,000, and give that away. And the remaining 45 grand, I would, you know, put towards joining more masterminds because, guys, like I mentioned earlier, like my life, my business has exponentially changed by the people I've surrounded myself with that are doing the same stuff, doing stuff even bigger than me. It just motivates me. You know, it lets you, you know, kind of skip some mistakes that others have made because they tell you to look out for it, right? And it's actually funny. That's also kind of a therapy session too. And what I mean by this is I'm sure you guys know it's hard to connect with people that aren't, you know, business owners, investors, entrepreneurs. They just can't relate to you. And the thing about this is it's a roller coaster ride. We have our good days and we have our bad days. My buddy actually called me yesterday. He was having a bad day and, you know, he just wanted to talk. And it's really cool that you can have that with a mastermind. So I would definitely join more masterminds with.
That's a great answer, Sean. It's so funny because Ryan and I see each other almost every day. or we're talking every day. We don't see each other every day. And when we're both having great days, it's amazing. It's like the best thing ever. When one of us isn't, the other one is, it's fine. We can get through. As long as we can both avoid bad days when we're together,
right,
then
right.
we're in good shape. But I don't think we really have a lot of those. I mean, like, I 100% understand what you're saying. That I don't think that I can have the same conversations with all of my friends. Doesn't mean I love them any less, but that I can have with us or certain minded friends, investors, and business partners. But that was a great answer. So question three, what has been your biggest mistake that you've made in your investing journey and how have you learned from it?
It's probably not hiring VAs, but
I know.
We'll take it a different way. I'll actually talk about it. Investment. This was when I was growing my personal portfolio of smaller multis. It was towards the end of the year. I wanted to get another deal because I wanted to get to 20 units, which is kind of probably an ego thing looking back. Also wanted some more depreciation before the end of the year. We actually closed on December 31st. And so the numbers look great, right? It bought it for like 158K. It had over $3,000 in gross, you know, monthly revenue. Like it was a fat deal, right? And I was like, this is a good deal. However, it wasn't in a strong market, New Hampshire. Two, went to meet the guy who was selling it, just kind of got a weird vibe from him. And then the day of closing, I went to go check out the house and the piece of land above it was being developed for a house. And so they put in a driveway that had an egress through my property or what would be my property. And what that did is it brought rain. So the direction of water was coming down and ripping through my property and tore it apart. And I had the opportunity to back out, but being, young, hungry and wanting more units, I said, that's fine. We'll worry about it later. Will you give me 5K off? Which he did.
Probably happily 5K off, right?
Yeah, I know. Right. No, and I look about it. He's like, he was so excited and he was doing backflips, I'm sure that guy was so excited to get rid of that. But it gets worse, guys. So then I close on the property and these tenants are just the worst tenants. Don't pay, can't evict them. And then once we do evict them, we go to turn the property. And one of the tenants who was like a contractor handyman, he ripped out all of the plumbing. He stole the heating from the second unit. And so we had to invest a lot more than we had budgeted.
This was one of your first couple deals.
Yeah. Luckily I was lucky that there was appreciation in the market and over the long term there was, and that I could like kind of just ride it. So we're fine on it, but it just goes to show you like, don't make an investment just to feed that ego, feed a number. And also even if it looks good underwriting on Excel, right? The numbers, oh, that's a fat deal. I'm going to make so much cash flow. Like that's not the only thing of underwriting. You got to go, you got to have a gut feeling. And I did have a gut feeling, but I just decided to ignore it. So that's probably my biggest mistake.
That's such a great story. And I'll never complain about anything that happens at my, cause my first property was like a disaster and not to that extent, even close, but I just had like everything that could have gone wrong, went wrong from a little bit lesser standpoint. And just to stick something out like that, to continue to push through and not be like, oh, real estate sucks. Like, I can't believe I got into this and then quit. So most people would have done, I mean, straight up. So I actually love the mistake stories because it helps shape you for future decisions.
Here's what I want to know too about this is like, we always seem to get one of these crazy stories, but I never hear the end result. So,
it gets worse. I just want to keep it clean for the podcast.
Oh, you have to stay too clean. No, we're not. No, but I do really quick. I want to hear the story, so you don't have to keep it clean. I'm sure our listeners are eager, but you have all this guy's information in his name. Like what an idiot. Like he obviously stole it. So can you take us through the next steps? Is it like X-rated? Are we good?
No, it's not X-rated. I've had X-rated other property. These are at bigger properties. Had to do with a laundry room, but we won't go there. But
there you go.
Wasn't X-rated. He, this guy's just a bad person. Like stole stuff, lied. He's got a criminal background, which I didn't know before. Some really bad criminal background stuff. And he threatened my property management, you know? So now when my property management went there afterwards, they were all, you know, concealed carry because they were just uncomfortable with the guy.
Wow.
He had a friend bring a camper and a lean-to up to the property, and this guy was doing drugs. It was just, it got really bad at one point. And luckily we got the sheriffs involved, and they were really good, and they cleaned him out and made sure they didn't come. Oh, and one point he was, when we finally got the eviction almost approved, he started burning his stuff in the backyard, like big flames. Like the neighbors complained, there was smoke. Yeah, this property is wild, guys. But
everyone's got a war story, man.
Yeah, man. It's just, and like, look how far you've come from that. I'm serious. A lot of people would have quit. Like they would have just, what, like, because you're at a point, especially where we invest, our properties are in the Northeast. It's hard to evict people up here, man. Like you can't just like kick people out. Like if you're investing in like Texas, like somebody doesn't pay for like one day, you're like evicted the next day. You know, it's like, and like, I'm not saying what's better or worse, but it's just harder as a landlord to make sure that you have to tiptoe that line. And that's why we loved hiring a property manager. Cause I just didn't want to deal with like oh, you know, I'm the owner and you're going to play on my heartstrings type stuff. So
yeah, I call them professional tenants cause they know how to play the game. And they know all the timelines and they know how long they can stay there, and they push it out.
Dude.
You lose so much money. Like we had a normal turnover, just a regular, you know, $2,500 in expenses, blah, blah, blah. It ended up costing us $7,000. And that was because we had to put a washer dryer in there. Yeah. Normal turnover stuff was like $2,500, lost out on a month's rent. And then the next month's rent went to the property manager. So I just did like that math. I can't even imagine in something like this. You're talking about actual property damage. You have to go through the legal process. You have to actually fix stuff. Then you have the vacancy. It's like, it's just like, yeah.
There's nothing you really can do on the legal side because he couldn't even afford to pay his rent, or at least he chose not to. We're not going to see any money from him, and I'm just going to spend money on attorney fees. So unfortunately, as much as I hate it, you just gotta let the guy go.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. It's wild. Well, last question in the core four, we'll get to more brighter futures. You kind of already probably answered it a little bit. So I'll just ask it anyways and feel free to provide color where you feel necessary. But what do you want your legacy to be? So what gets you out of bed every morning to do what you do? Kind of what's your why in this whole thing?
Yeah, I just want to help others. And I've alluded to it earlier, like Greenbrier Capital Group, my company, Greenbrier was the street I grew up on. And you know, my family gave a lot for me, sacrificed a lot for me to get where I am. And I want to be able to give back to them, both my parents, my sister, and then the family I'm probably going to build in the future. And on top of that, I also want to give back to others. And like I mentioned, we donate at least 10% of our profits to causes that we like. Like I don't know if you guys have heard of the Underground Railroad Project. They battle child trafficking, human trafficking, specifically with children. Wow. And that's and then children, starving, we like to donate to that. And then my partner, his wife's family is from Venezuela, and we all know that that's kind of a dire situation. So we want to set up whether it's like a nonprofit or some type of fund where we can help first get her family out and then other people too. So that keeps us going. And another thing is when you walk on some of these properties, specifically the B and C class properties, I was just at one last week where we're putting $2 million in CapEx. And one of the greatest feelings is when the tenants come up to you and thank you for improving this property, because it's what they call home. Unfortunately, not everyone can afford to buy their own home, or they just don't want to, but they still want a nice place to live. And being able to provide that, it's just such a great feeling when they come up and really appreciate that. So that's another thing that keeps me going.
Love it, man, that your story is all about other people. And that's really what makes the world go around. So thank you for sharing. That's awesome. And looks like we made it to the last drop. Knowing what you know now, what advice would you give your younger self? I think you mentioned you're 32. Let's say you went back to like your 18-year-old self, Sean. What would you tell him if he would listen?
Yeah, I wonder if you would. I think the easy thing to say is, go bigger sooner, start sooner. But I think what I would say is have fun, but not too much fun. You have a lot of life left to have fun. Let's spread it out, right? And also that the saying, especially when you're younger, do things that most people won't, so you can live a life in the future that most people can't. and just start that as young as possible. Like I said earlier, you know, the famous quote, you know, compound interest is the eighth wonder of the world. Yeah. And that's in anything in life, not just investing, but small actions you take every single day compound over time. So start young. Like, yeah, you still can go on, you know, a vacation a year, go out to dinner. Like, I'm not the type of person that says, like, don't buy that Starbucks coffee, don't buy that avocado toast. Like, that's not me. It's, everything's in moderation, but like, keep it in moderation and focus on things that can improve your life. And that's what I tell myself, just get after it early. You know, why not work hard now so then you can have all the fun when you're a little bit older, but have a lot more fun.
Yeah, I love that. And we just recently came into a position where we're starting to make more income. And I've noticed that the spending the money on like lunches and small things like that, like that's not going to stop us from getting to our goals. Like, right. And especially when you get to a certain level where it feels like, okay, as long as I'm taking this 25K, 50K, 75,000, whatever that number is, and putting it into a deal or putting it into the next thing that can bring me income, you know, the whole small, really small, like coffees and stuff like that. I don't think it makes enough of an impact for you to not enjoy, do those things that you enjoy. You don't have to eat shit for 10 years. Like, you just have to be intentional. So I love that answer. And I wish I could tell my younger self that too, but we're on a good path now. So Sean, thank you so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure. I think we haven't had anybody break down syndications, private money, some private money on previous episodes, but syndications the way that you did. I love what you're doing in student rentals. I think it's excellent. So thanks so much for sharing your story with us.
Hey guys, Ryan, Corey, thanks so much for having me on, guys. It's been a privilege and an honor.
Real quick, forgot to mention, if people love your story, they want to network with you, they want to reach out, what's the best way for people to get in touch with you?
Yeah. So I have a podcast too, Multifamily Money Podcast. You can find that, you know, anywhere you listen to podcasts, but the best way to actually communicate with me is either on Instagram, that's Sean Wins REI, or on LinkedIn, just search Sean Winslow and you can find me. And then our website is greenbriercg.com.
Love it. Thank you, Sean.
Thanks for tuning in this week to the Weekly Juice Podcast. If you liked what you heard, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, subscribe, and share with friends. The more ratings we get, the more ears we'll get on our show, and in turn, we'll be able to provide you with more high-quality guests. You can also find us on Instagram at Weekly Juice Pod, where we post daily tips and tricks and document our own journey towards financial freedom. Make sure to tune in every Wednesday to get your weekly juice.